Hello and welcome to Playback Daily. It's Wednesday, the 8th of May. I'm Louise Herity and here's some of what's coming up.
So I think the tagline is based on a true story overheard in a pub. So it's kind of a dark comedy, like look at kind of small Irish towns.
I thought it was really nice, and I was very honoured that Sweden had asked me to do the guest spot in the first semi-final. And sing one of the most famous Swedish winners. And I thought that was just such an honour.
People say that it's very good for your circulatory system, your cholesterol, and I'm not a doctor myself, but I know when I'm out and about, why wouldn't you pick it? Why wouldn't you introduce it into your diet, connect to nature, and it saves you a few bob as well.
Well, Eurovision fever was very much in the air today after Ireland and Bambi Thug qualified for the final for the first time since 2018. And Morning Ireland brought us this report from Evelyn O'Rourke, who spoke to Bambi's mother, Laura, in Malmo amid the celebrations.
I'm feeling so proud and I just can't wait for Saturday. I think we're going to have a ball. We've been having a ball here. There's a huge contingent here and everybody's really supportive. As you can hear, we're never going to get away from this, you know. We will live on with this for so long and we will just celebrate and celebrate. It's fantastic.
I interviewed them earlier and I have to say, Bobby was quietly calm. Like, I was very impressed because it was a huge amount of pressure. Yeah. Sitting there tonight, like, that's a big stage.
Yeah, it is a big stage. And a few people asked me how are they feeling, and I said, I think they're fine. They handle it very well. And they always did. They always handle the stage very well, you know. I said, that's what they live for. And we all saw that tonight anyway. I thought it was brilliant.
Performance was extraordinary. The energy, the passion, the storytelling.
Yeah. Their attention to detail is unbelievable. It really is. Yeah, it is. And they just have huge imagination. And they always have had, you know. I'm really proud.
Can I finally ask you, this message of inclusivity, I've been saying all day, I feel children in particular have just really taken Bambi's message to heart.
Absolutely.
Do you feel that? Do you see that?
I do. I have a cousin living in Liverpool. And they were all voting tonight. They had a big Eurovision party. And one of the things that my cousin Helen texted me was to tell me that she has a few friends whose teenagers are transitioning. And she said that the support that they feel from Bambi Thug is phenomenal. And it made me cry, actually. I thought it was just fantastic. Very, very proud.
Bambi Thug's mother, Laura, affectionately known by fans as a Mambi, chatting to RTE's Evelyn O'Rourke. And later we heard more from Evelyn on Morning Ireland, including a catch-up with Bambi.
Well, good morning, Evelyn.
Good morning, Mary Wilson. How are you this morning?
I'm very well. Did you know that Bambi, who's from Macroom, as you know, which is just up the road from Mill Street, which was the scene of the Eurovision the year they were born, could they bring the contest back here once more?
Well, let's play the tape from yesterday where I said that absolutely Bambi 100% was going to get through to the final. Look, I mean, we're always cautious as journalists, and yesterday morning I went as far as I could with you to say that it was looking good. But secretly, of course, inside, just the buzz was so positive around them. The bookies, which they tend to take these things quite seriously. The predictions were so strong internationally. The predictions are very strong. But just talking to the general fans around the arena, not the Irish fans, but the real Eurovision fans, they loved Bambi Thug. They loved the message. They loved the act. And it was funny, I was thinking about it last night. I think what they did so well is they told a story. And sitting in the stadium, I was so lucky to get in to sit in for the concert last night. It stood out in that sense because lots of the other songs are lovely, but they're quite bland in a way. When Bambi Thug came out, you went, oh, there's a story happening here. There's a start, middle and end. It's dramatic, it's dark, it's emotional. But at times as well, it's quite light. Now, as I talk to you, Mary, I am in the middle of Malmo and the fashion shop right beside me has just started blasting out Johnny Logan. Hold me now. This has nothing to do with me. This is a total coincidence. But of course, Johnny was on stage last night and what a job he did. So it was a really exciting, rewarding night for Irish fans last night. We had Bambi Thug doing their thing and then Johnny Logan came out and they were calling him Royal Highness, and just the love and respect for him was astonishing. So yes, Ireland is really in top form here in Malmo today.
Bambi must be on a high.
Bambi is on a high. They gave a press conference last night. I think we've a little flavour of that just to hear the reaction from Bambi Thug. So I think we're going to have a little listen now to Bambi Thug responding to their win last night.
I'm super proud, as our team is very small, and I'm an independent artist, and it's incredible that we've reached here. You know, our country hasn't been here since 2018. And I'm the first non-binary artist to qualify. So that is incredible. See you Saturday.
See you Saturday. Evelyn, talk us through the next few days now and the Saturday performance.
Well, I know you're talking, you're hearing from Bambi Thug this morning, Bambi's mom, who came up to me outside the Rida last night, and they were like, "This is the mom." I was like, "Great, let's chat." And you could see from her the relief that they'd got through. So I think it's going to be joy actually for the next few days for them as they prepare for that final on Saturday, because all the plans kicked in, all the plans worked for them. The look was good, the design was good. I presume there's going to be a rest day today, and there's some rehearsals then tomorrow. The busy thing then Friday, they start rehearsing again. Again, these are ticketed events. And my understanding is that the jury see the performance on Friday night. So Friday night in real life matters here in Malmo. But for us as an audience at home, Saturday is obviously the big thing. And I think the next thing that's going to happen is on Friday they'll do the draw. It seems to matter where you come in the draw. That is the all-important thing. So fingers crossed that we'll get a good slot for that. Then otherwise on Malmo tomorrow, Mary Israel performing tomorrow night. And there is some expectation that there'll be protests during the day. There is a heavy security presence around the arena. Getting in is not easy. You have to have, it's like airport style security. You can only bring literally a wallet in with you. So the arena is very much blocked off. But the rest, Malmo's a big, big city, so it'll be interesting to see the scale of the protest tomorrow. But they are talking about thousands of people coming to Malmo tomorrow. Okay. So I suppose that's the next big thing here.
RTE's media and arts correspondent Evelyn O'Rourke reporting live from Malmo on Morning Ireland. Later on Liveline, callers were reliving Eurovision memories and praising Bambi Thug, and Katie Hannum was also joined by Eurovision royalty.
And we're having a Eurovision party here today. And what would a Eurovision party be without a touch of this?
Such a long time looking out for you, but you're not here. What's another year? I've been waking such a long time reaching out for you.
And I'm delighted to say good afternoon to the King of Eurovision, Johnny Logan.
I said, you can call me Your Majesty. Thank you. That was a very nice introduction I got last night, I must say, in Sweden. I didn't know whether to be modest or just say, well, finally, okay.
It was fantastic.
Thank you.
Just everything about the song, the performance.
They'd asked me in November. It was really hard. Like, sort of, I'm not very good at keeping my mouth shut about certain things, but they had approached me in November, December of last year, and asked me to be involved with it. And I'd agreed, and we had decided on what I would do. And then when I heard the arrangement, the orchestral arrangement of because you see, Sweden had won it 7 times, and we had won it 7 times. And I thought it was a really, really, really nice, and I was very honoured that Sweden had asked me to do the guest spot in the first semi-final, sing one of the most famous Swedish winners. And I thought that was just such an honour, and to be able to, and also the opportunity to represent my country again, you know, like one more time.
Oh, it was just so special to see you there, and the big, big introduction you got when you came on stage, and the reaction in the auditorium to you was just...
It was unreal.
Wasn't it?
It was unreal. And it's so weird because when we were rehearsing, because it's a symphonic arrangement, and, you know, there's no drums or anything like this, you know, being played to give you time. So normally when I'm singing, I only use one of the in-ears in my right ear. And... you know, I can now listen. I have what they call little speakers in front of me called wedges. Mm-hmm. And I can hear, you know, that way I can hear the audience and I can hear what's going on. But because of the fact that there was no rhythm, there was no shaker or click track, and I had to hear the piano and the arrangement, they asked me would I put two in-ears in, and I'd never sung with two in before. And it was like the weirdest, it was almost claustrophobic, you know, but I couldn't hear the audience in the same way that like sort of you could on TV, you know, like sort of or the people in the arena could hear. But even at that, when I finished, I could hear what what went up, and I turned to Carl Johan, the piano player, who had done the arrangement, and I just saw the grin on his face, and I knew that it must be something else. You know?
It was something else. Can we just hear how you were introduced? If anyone didn't hear it last night going out, because it was brilliant.
Before the Queen, there was a king. An Irishman, yes, who won the Eurovision, yes, as a singer in both 1980 and 87, and as a composer in 1992. And I can't put into words how much he meant to me as a young girl watching the Eurovision at home. His Royal Highness, Johnny Logan.
There you are. And online, the reaction was brilliant as well. Let me read you a couple of tweets or a couple of posts on X. Greg Murphy said, in a shock twist, Johnny Logan has been crowned Eurovision winner. In a statement, all Eurovision 2024 contestants said, yay, that's fair. Hard to argue with that.
That my son sent me that. I thought that's brilliant. I mean, I'm always enjoying watching other people being written about, so the least I can do is take it on the chin where it's meant. But I got the people from the TV show this morning. I left at about 7 o'clock Malmo this morning, back from Copenhagen, mm-hmm. And the people at the show though were already reading me the things that were up the on Instagram and the social media. Reaction to the performance, and it's wonderful. I mean, to be honest, I was quite emotional because a lot of it, like, sort of was so, you know, so wonderful, you know, so positive, and it was I suppose to go back to the Eurovision stage in 2024, 44 years after winning the first one, and to be in that situation where you walk out in the middle of an orchestra. You know, kind of that was enough to take my breath away, and then, but to see the reaction people had to my performance and to the song itself, and I think it was just wonderful.
It's still happening, Johnny. We just got a text in. Can you tell Johnny that all of us here in a local bookshop in Sligo love his humility and lack of vanity? That's from Janet and staff. And another one that I saw last night, which I have to repeat, is I keep rewatching Johnny Logan's exquisite performance, and I can't help but notice his slight resemblance to Patrick Swayze.
You could dig Patrick up now, and he'd still look better than me. You know, Patrick. That used to happen to me back in '87. I actually, in Covent Garden, I had a girl chasing after me, and she actually wanted to know could she kiss me because I looked like Patrick Swayze. And it's, you know, of course you can, but so this is, you know, like sort of I think during that period that was his Roadhouse and the Ghost period and this sort of thing, and I think. You know, every guy would have been happy to look like Patrick Swayze back in those days. But the reality of it is that sort of it's, you know, like people have been throughout my life have always been really, really kind to me and really, you know, like I think because I think I'd like to think I'm quite approachable and I'm, you know, I like people. And I think we said it last night when we finished the performance, we went into a room like you're being led up because there's so much happening there. And all of the string players, they're all young kids and stuff like this, well, in their 20s. And they were all sort of, they wanted to get a group photograph. And Carl Johan, the guy who did the arrangement, was kind of like, was so nice. He just said, of all of the people, he'd worked with some of the biggest artists in Sweden and this. And he said, not all of them are as nice as Johnny Logan. And you kind of make it feel like sort of it's, you know, I whatever has happened to me throughout my life, I've always tried to treat people with respect and with dignity and this sort of thing. And it's returning to me in so many ways. And it does really, you know, like sort of it really makes it really is something very special for me, even to hear that thing from Sligo. And thank you guys down there so much for saying it.
Everyone, of course, remarking about how astonishingly fabulous you look. And we had Paul Harrington on earlier. He was reminding us you share a birthday. He's
yeah,
a little bit younger
May,
than
yes.
he's a little bit younger
our
than you.
Next week.
Yeah. So it's a big birthday coming up, a roundy birthday, as they say.
Yeah. We always wish each other happy birthday on that day, Paul and myself. That's one thing. That's another thing we share apart from winning the Eurovision. But, you know, and if Paul's listening, you know, happy birthday. I'm heading off, like sort of for a few days away, but like sort of I'll be thinking about you, Paul. No, I won't. I'll send you a text and wish you a happy birthday, but I hope your day will be as good as mine, or mine will be as good as yours, Paul.
How do you do it is what everyone wants to know, Johnny. How do you keep, you look so well,
know,
you
just,
sound so well, your voice is incredible still.
It's not, well, you know, like sort of, to be honest, this year I lost my brother, my older brother, Michael.
Oh, I'm sorry.
In November last year, and that I found that when I stopped working at Christmas, I found it very hard to... in January, February, and it's been a battle to get back there. But I mean, I don't drink, I don't smoke. Now I've had to give up sweets because I got very close to being diabetic. I did 26 concerts in Belgium in the summer in Bruges, and the fans kept bringing me box of chocolates, and I kept eating them. So my sugar levels went way up. So I said, I was told stop it. And when I did that, I lost a. Came down about two or three sizes in shirt, and I'm just, you know, I've all my life I've worked out. I've always been in and out of gyms, and it's just because I think, you know, I'm 69 years old, 70 on the 13th of May, and I think it's really, really important to be as fit as you possibly can. I think I saw a great picture of Mick Jagger and what was Mitch McConnell, the House Speaker. Republican House Speaker,
and they're the same
who's
age.
Just retired, a picture, and they're both the same age. And who said that somebody had written underneath it, who says rock and roll isn't good for you, you know?
Johnny Logan on Liveline with Katie Hannon today. On Today with Colm O'Mungon, the host talked about how we're on the cusp of a new wave of chronic diseases that will emerge in 15 to 20 years. That's according to new research into flavoured vapes, which authors claim has uncovered harmful chemicals that are produced when the e-liquids in the vapes are heated for inhalation. The study was carried out by a research team at RCSI, University of Medicine and Health Sciences, and Colm was joined by lead author of the study and Professor of Chemistry, Dr. Donal O'Shea.
Good morning, Colm. Thanks for having me on the show.
You're very welcome. The study is specifically looked at flavoured vapes, and there are quite a few of those. So how many did you test and how did you test them?
So what we looked at were the actual 180 different chemical flavors that are used to make up the commercial flavored products. And we examined them by using artificial intelligence to predict what would happen when these were heated within the vaping devices themselves. So we could see what the breakdown products would be from heating these particular flavors.
And just for anyone who's not familiar with that kind of a method, you weren't testing them on people or animals, you were using AI. So would you be confident that those, in, I suppose, the integrity of those results?
Yes, we would be, because there has been some experimental work done by others, and we can see that we are also predicting what has been found experimentally in these smaller studies. So the importance of going to an AI approach was that, as you know, this sort of area of vaping, especially in the younger demographic, is rapidly expanding, and there's a lot of uncertainty and unknown about what's being produced in these particular products. So using artificial intelligence, we can look at the entirety of all the different flavors that are being used in a single go and predict what's going to happen. And in that way, we can then follow up with experimental evidence at a later stage, but we can get a good insight into what really is occurring in these devices, and from there be able to understand what medical impacts will come down the line, maybe in 10, 15 years from now.
So you're looking at flavours which are made up of chemicals. They're in one form when they're in liquid form, but then the effect of heating on them, what happens to them?
Yeah, so with any chemical, if you heat it to a high temperature, it tends to break down into a variety of different other chemicals. So essentially one chemical flavour could break down into 10 to 20 different compounds. And that's the huge uncertainty that's still unknown. So what we've been trying to do is predict what those compounds are. And then with that knowledge, we can see what the health impacts of them would be.
And what did you find?
So what we find is that there are very toxic compounds being predicted to be formed. Some of them have been experimentally detected before. So really, in essence, if you think out into the future for a prolonged long-term exposure of lungs to this, that we are going to see new diseases emerge in the future, cancers, cardiovascular diseases, and injuries to lungs. It's almost a certainty. You don't necessarily have to be a scientist or a medical doctor to understand this or to see the dangers that are here.
Right, and new disease. Is this because humans haven't been exposed to, I suppose, intense doses of these heated chemicals heretofore?
It never have been before. So never have these compounds been heated to high temperatures and directly inhaled into the lungs. They're used in food products, and they've got a good safety profile there, where we eat them in our sweets and our soft drinks and in our arsley pastries, but never have they been used in this fashion before, and that's never been tested. So not only do we have the inherent risk of the flavors themselves, of which in any flavored vape, there could be anywhere from half a dozen to 20 different chemicals to make up that commercial flavor. And then you have all the heating breakdown products that have been formed as well. So there's a huge cocktail of unknown chemicals being delivered to the lungs every time somebody vapes.
And as far as you're aware, before these products made it to market, had any kind of an experiment like this been carried out before by anybody regulating this sector?
No, they have not been tested in this fashion before. And because that type of testing from an academic point of view is very challenging and costly, that's why we've gone to an AI approach to try to get a bird's eye overview of all the different things that can be happening from all the different individual flavor components. And in that way, try to inform the community as to what to look for.
All right. You said there's about 180 flavors. Are they as bad as each other, or are some worse than others? What did you find?
So some are worse than others. But I think what we should be focusing on also are not just the ones that are worse than others, but the ones that are most commonly used and most popular. And looking at those ones, they most certainly have issues with them. And they are flavors such as fruit flavors, sweet flavors, and candy flavors. So all those compounds we can see will be breaking down upon action of heat on them, producing a whole host of different compounds that are then immediately inhaled into the lungs. So they're the ones, I think, that need urgent attention.
And what is it about those sweet flavors that makes them particularly toxic?
They have a specific set of chemistry to them that are very prone to breaking down upon heating. And so it's a technical thing, but they have specific groups called esters, and that's what gives them that nice sweet or fruit flavors and aromas. And it is that bit that is susceptible to heat.
Okay, and what's the effect of those on human health, on human tissue?
Yeah, so what we can do is that when we see all the compounds that are being predicted that be produced, we can look at what's known about their toxicities. Because they are predominantly known compounds, and they have been tested for toxicities. And we can see that many, many of them are health hazard classified, some are acute toxic, and some are irritants. So we can then look at the profile of each individual component and sort of say, well, we inherently are risking cancers for this type of products that are being produced, or lung damage from this type of product, and so on. So because there are so many, you have to sort of mine into each one individually to see what would actually be predicted for it. But in essence, the challenge we have is that each one of those chemicals, remember, is blended into a commercial product. So there could be 5 or 6, up to 10 different ones in that product. And every product is different. So what we're sort of saying is that we have to look at the whole entity of all the flavors and begin to consider whether it is wise to have them in vape products at all.
All right. And so this is a longitudinal, albeit an AI study. You looked at what might happen over 10 to 15 years. So for somebody using flavored vapes over 10 to 15 years, what's the risk profile? How likely are they to become sick as a result of using them?
I think looking at the types of chemicals that are being produced, I think the likelihood is quite high. It may not be exactly the same as tobacco smoking, because different chemicals are also being produced in tobacco smoke than are not in vapes, and vice versa. So there will be differences. So I think a direct comparison with tobacco smoke is difficult, but if you compare to somebody who is not vaping, I think your risk of disease will be significantly higher, and we will see this happening in 10 to 15 years' time.
All right. And are you able to say at this point, at risk, but a risk of what order in terms of how more likely somebody who's smoking vapes or vaping, should I say, is more likely than someone who's not?
So the problem to get it down to that level of accuracy is difficult because all the flavors have different chemical components in them. And all the vaping devices are different with different heating and temperature profiles, depending upon the power of the battery in it and so on, and the makeup of the components in it. So unlike, say, tobacco smoking, where there might have been a half a dozen different brands, all containing tobacco leaf, every different vape device and vape solution is different. So it's going to be difficult to actually quantify which one will be the most dangerous. So it's such a diverse landscape, to make that type of accurate prediction is not possible at this stage, unfortunately.
And you, as you mentioned there, you're comparing the effects of tobacco and the effects of vaping. There are many who'll argue that, you know, despite the risks of vaping, it can be useful as a smoking cessation tool for people who are tobacco smokers.
Yeah. So that, like, in terms of quitting tobacco smoke, I think what we also urge me is to get as much support to people who are attempting to do this, especially in the older generation. But what we're risking here is just transferring a new scourge to the younger generation as this issue is tried to be addressed in terms of people who are addicted to tobacco. If you look at what's happening now in the literature and what's been reported, is that there's sort of a sense in the community that vaping might be a cure-all for tobacco smoking, but that's maybe proving to be a false promise.
Right. There's a market all of its own of people who may never have taken up tobacco smoking. Is that what you're saying?
That's becoming the predominant market now. So, and also just the evidence that whether vaping will help people long-term with quitting tobacco smoking, and is it any better than other nicotine replacement therapies, whether it's patches or gums and so on, that the evidence isn't very strong to say that it's much better or worse than the others. And for example, our HSE don't recommend vaping as a method for quitting tobacco smoking. So to achieve that, because it's such a difficult addiction, in terms of addiction to nicotine, I think you need to have a professional advice from your GP, from your pharmacist, to really guide you on how best to do that on an individual basis.
All right. Well, I suppose over the course of many years, the impact of tobacco was monitored. In your AI experiment, it's replicated the effects over decades. So in terms of passing this on then to regulators and recommending action on this, does your report contain recommendations, or do you have any recommendations yourself?
Yeah, so what we're recommending is that, you know, urgently we have to look at the number of chemical components in these particular vaping products. A recognition that they have not been tested for the type of use that they're currently being used for, and that information is not really very widely known in the vaping community. So really we have to restrict the number of chemicals that go in there, and that means really strictly reducing the number of flavors is what we would be recommending.
And any thoughts on information to consumers and advertising within shops?
Well, I think it's sort of self-evident to everybody who looks at one of these shops. They're advertised and retailed as if they're sort of sweets or candies and chocolate bars. They look very similar, very colourful packaging and so on. So in terms of all of that, it needs to be addressed as well, that the packaging should be plain and it shouldn't be really marketed on a brand of a flavour or of a specific sweet or so on.
Okay.
But I think that's essential for the younger non-smoking generation, that they don't become addicted to nicotine through these products.
Dr. Donal O'Shea on Today with Colm O'Mungon. On the Oliver Callan Show, we heard about a brand new series set in West Cork that's coming to Netflix. It's made by the production team owned by the Obamas and stars Clodagh Mooney-Duggan, who spoke to Oliver.
Good morning, how are you?
And congratulations on this fantastic new series that you're featuring in.
Yeah, thank you. I'm really, really over the moon. I'm delighted.
Now, tell us what about Bodkin. It's an unusual name.
It is. So Bodkin is actually the name of the town So what it is a group of podcasters and an investigative journalist go to this town in West Cork called Bodkin to investigate three people who have gone missing.
Union Hall doubles as Bodkin, isn't that the real life? Yes. Union Hall in West Cork, proper West Cork.
Proper West Cork, yeah. They just kind of put Bodkin signs over the street signs.
I presume because it features podcasters stumbling into a cold case, there must be some comedic elements to it, I hope.
There is, yeah. So I think the tagline is based on a true story overheard in a pub. So it's kind of a dark comedy, like, look at kind of small Irish towns.
Very good.
And how people kind of hold secrets very close to their chest.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, Clodagh, before we get into the how the show was made and so on.
Yeah, so I was born in Wexford in New Ross.
Yeah.
And I got into drama maybe when I was about 12 or 13. Fell into it kind of by accident. I started in a youth theatre called County Wexford Youth Theatre. And I was there for years. And then when it was time to go to college, I went to the Gaiety School of Acting. And then I was there for 2 full years. And then I've been kind of tipping away ever since graduating, which was about 10 years ago now.
They produce loads of successes, and now of which you're one. It must have been hugely exciting to get the call and to be added to this Netflix company.
Kind of unbelievable, yeah. There was a few steps to it. I did an audition online over video, and then I did another one through Zoom because it was still kind of in COVID times, and met the director, Nash, and then got the phone call. I was over the moon. I still am.
Well, even the timeline you're giving us there shows how long it takes to put something of this size to put together.
It does, yeah. I mean, filming wrapped, I think, at the very end of October in 2022. So just to kind of do the edits for the full 7 episodes would have taken about a year and a half.
Have you seen the series yourself, by the way?
I've only seen bits of it. So my first time seeing all of the series, all of the episodes, will be on the 9th with everyone else.
Oh, right, okay. So you give us kind of the tone of it there. It's kind of a comedic thriller, really. Three podcasters investigating the cold case in this lovely coastal town. When it was being filmed, the production design people, and I'd imagine something with Netflix is of an order you wouldn't have seen before because of the budgets they have.
Yeah, I mean, it was just wonderful. A lot of the sets that they built like an entire pub, and they built an entire like B&B all inside kind of warehouses in Dublin. It's just the most incredible machine. Everyone is so talented. And there's also, it appears on Samhain, like the night of the celebration, and there's just puppetry, and how they created the celebratory nature of the town is stunning. It's a beast unto itself.
So they use warehouses in Dublin to build these sound stages that look like the innards of
an
Irish country town.
Yeah, exactly, in Ardmore Studios.
Wow. And who do you play in it?
I play a character called Mary. Mary is, she's a mortician, firstly, but she's kind of, she's sarcastic and spunky and a kind of a little bit, like there's wildness to the eyes, but she's also very loving and caring, and she's got that lovely duality as a character.
A wild mortician. All right. Was that easy for you
to? I was born to play.
Is that right? Okay. What kind of research? Did you have to talk to anybody in this macabre profession in order to slip into this role?
I did, actually. I spoke to an undertaker who was a woman. We met on set one day. It was just fascinating to learn, well, firstly, kind of the mechanics of her job, but then how she got into it and what her day-to-day looks like. It was just fascinating. But yeah, I did speak to a mortician to get into the role.
Yeah, well, it just shows the amount of work that you have to do to do this kind of thing. Bodkin,
yeah.
We noticed, it's an unusual name, by the way, Bodkin, isn't it? It is made by Higher Ground Production Company, and Barack and Michelle Obama are obviously the force behind that company. Do they have any involvement at all in what they make?
Yeah, I think they do. I think they have an awful lot behind the scenes. Now, I wouldn't have met them when I was filming in Wicklow, but I think they do have quite a bit of involvement in it.
It's so unusual, though, isn't it, just to think the Obamas are behind this show set in West Cork, sort of comedy murder that's going on.
Kind of unfathomable.
Isn't
and, like,
it?
The image of them sitting down to watch it is very entertaining in my brain.
And particularly in that professional capacity and sort of critiquing it and wondering, is this the right direction for their company? But
they
did get, I believe they sent some note, did they, to the cast and crew?
They did. They sent like lovely thank you notes after we had wrapped to all the actors and presumably the crew. They were quite behind it the whole time.
So you'll have to print out something there and hang it on a wall for sure.
And get it framed and put on T-shirts. Yeah.
I believe you have embarrassingly proud parents.
Yeah, I do.
Give them a shout out.
I really do. Yeah, Michael Duggan and Susan Mooney. They're, God love them. I'm an only child, so it does. It comes with the territory.
Ah.
But yeah, they are.
I love how you're not embarrassing them back either.
Yeah, I know. I would never. No, they are. God love them. But no, it's lovely. They're just very proud and delighted. I suppose because it's been such a long trek. You know, I've been doing it since I was 13. So
yeah.
You're
steeped in this profession. We know now that you're featuring in Bodkin, which is coming to Netflix very soon. You also work in theatre.
I do. So I've kind of been doing both sides of it since I graduated. So like I've produced and I've directed, I've written, but I also work on the art side of it. So I'm currently working in the Axis Theatre as a front of house manager and a project coordinator. So I kind of work behind the scenes as well, getting shows together and projects together.
Is that something you just love? The theatre, the energy behind the scenes and the kind of anticipation before showtime. It's different every day, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. Like once I kind of caught the bug for it, you couldn't get me away from theatre, really. Seeing actors prepare and get ready and the buzz and then the audience come in, get their ticket, like the whole, from start to finish, I love it.
What's next?
What's next for me is I'm writing a show for young audiences.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
called Made from Paper. So it's going to be the Christmas show in The Mermaids.
Oh, brilliant.
For audience of 8+ in Bray. Yeah.
Lovely theatre, yeah. Made from Paper, and you've written that yourself.
Yeah, I've written that myself. And a friend of mine, Nessa Matthews, is directing it. It's about a girl who's made from paper, so she can't go outside because it rains all the time.
Right.
Then she falls in love with a woman out the window, so she has to leave.
Oh my God, that's terribly sad.
Yeah.
But I'm sure something merry will happen since it's a Christmas play. And
I have until Christmas to make something merry happen.
Very good. And that's for younger people. How young are the younger people? Because some of us think we're young.
Yeah, well, we're looking at 8+ at the moment. It may turn into 6+.
Something for the kids. Brilliant.
But
in the meantime,
the kids.
We'll be watching out for the plucky, fun mortician down in West Cork, who's Mary, but it's Clodagh Mooney Duggan is the one to look out for. And that it's out on Netflix this week. They can enjoy it into the weekend. Bodkin.
That's it, yeah.
Clodagh, it's been a pleasure. Good luck with everything you do and enjoy life that you have chosen.
I will.
Exit stage
Thank
left.
Thank you very much.
Clodagh Mooney Duggan chatting to Oliver Callan. If you're out and about in the country or city parks during the month of May, it'll be hard to miss the hawthorn. It's a native tree and steeped in folklore and tradition. And Aideen Tiernig runs Bláthanna Fiona Wildflower Walks on Inishman. She joined Colm to fill us in.
The hawthorn, a very common tree, so why is the month of May so associated with it?
Well, it's also known as the May tree, and really and truly, if you're going anywhere in Ireland during the month of May, doesn't matter whether you're down a back road Bohareen or if you're on the motorways, you're going to see the hawthorn everywhere you go. It's blooming, it's beautiful. Anywhere you're seeing these gorgeous hedgerows covered in a creamy white flower, that's your hawthorn. And this is the way things are always in Ireland with your wild plants. The more common something is, the more folklore you have about it, the more traditions, the more pishogues, and the more traditional uses. So the hawthorn is rich in all of those ways and all around us.
And something I didn't know before I was preparing to speak to you today, it's something that was eaten in the past.
Eaten in the past and eaten in the present, Colm. It's absolutely delicious. So this is a gorgeous thing to supplement your diet with. This time of year in general is really, really good for our wild greens. Later in the season, of course, we'll have our fruits and things. But right now, get out on your lunch break and bring a little bag or fill your pocket with some wild greens. So things like your hawthorn leaf is really nice and very versatile to use. It's just like a lettuce, you know, it's a very mild taste. So when the leaves are young, before they get too big, once they get big, they get a little bit tougher, or if it's very windy, you might see some of them, they might be a little bit burnt on the edges by the wind. But a nice little hawthorn leaf is a perfect thing to introduce into your salad. As I say, it's just like a lettuce, it's a very mild green, but it's really, really good for you. And this is the thing, people long ago, they lived much more in tune with not just seasonal things that we grow in the garden, like we eat spuds, of course, when they come into season, and carrots and that, but our wild greens. And when they came into season, people just they supplemented their diet with them. And when you live like that, when you introduce wild foods when they're in season into your diet, you're getting what your body needs. You know, you're living more in tune with nature. So people say that it's very good for your circulatory system, your cholesterol. And I'm not a doctor myself, but I know when I'm out and about, why wouldn't you pick it? Why wouldn't you introduce it into your diet? Connect to nature, and it saves you a few bob as well, rather than buying heads of lettuce.
We should have maybe asked Paddy Barrett about some of the science behind that when we had him in earlier. But I suppose the flowers on the tree, is there eating or indeed drinking in them?
Well, certainly. Personally, I don't like the taste of the flowers. However, we filmed Fuí Vlá a couple of years ago for RTE, and we got a really nice recipe from Karen Mueller, who runs Solaris Tea in Galway. And she gave us a delicious jug of hawthorn lemonade. So you make your normal lemonade mix with your sugar, your lemon, your water, all those nice, easy things to find. And then you just pick a few hawthorn flowers off the tree and leave them into steep overnight. And what that does is it infuses the lemonade with this kind of like a spicy kick, which gives it a very unusual but really nice flavour. And also you're getting all those antioxidants, you're getting all that goodness as well from the flower.
All right. And the berries, the haws themselves, they're edible too, are they?
They are. And they're really nice, actually. So the fruit of the haw, now we won't get them until maybe September in that. But they kind of taste like a soft apple. Now, you can't eat the seeds. The seeds aren't edible, but the fruits are very, very nice. And again, this was a real staple of the diet, especially in Inishmeon. You hear loads of stories from the people about when they'd go for their lunch break in school, all the primary school kids would go out and they'd be stuffing their pockets with the haws, and they'd be eating them kind of sneakily then back in the classroom after lunch break. And the big fun, of course, was spitting out the seeds at the end. So you'd be firing them around the class. And if the teacher had their back turned, depending on how popular he or she was, they might get a little hawthorn seed thrown at the back
and
of their head.
And there was no, they weren't afraid of bringing the haws into the classroom because it's associated with bad luck. Why is that?
Well, it is. That's a very, very common pishog superstition belief, whatever you want to call it in Ireland. The hawthorn was always considered to be a fairy tree, very deeply connected with the fairies. Everyone really in every locality would have a story about someone who interfered with a fairy tree. So normally, the hawthorn is considered to be a fairy tree when it's a lone tree and it was connected with the other world, it was connected with bad luck. And there's so many stories about a farmer who took a notion to maybe fell this lone hawthorn tree, and more often than not, wouldn't one of the spikes from the tree go into the eye and the poor farmer be left blinded forevermore, God help us. So in that instance, they're considered to be very unlucky, but that doesn't really apply to the fruits or the leaves. However, it was never the done thing to bring a hawthorn blossom into the house. Even my own mother would have had this. She got it from her mother, who was from Fermanagh. But all over Ireland, it was considered to be deathly unlucky. And the belief was it would bring death into the home. Now, this is really, really common. However, what I find fascinating is people have actually, like scientists have analysed now the blossom of the hawthorn and discovered that there is a sneaky little chemical in there called triethylamine. And triethylamine, even though it's a mouthful, is present in the hawthorn blossom, which some people think is a really beautiful smell. By the way, you mentioned vanilla and walnut and all these lovely things. However, this chemical is also found in a rotting human corpse, cred nu na cred.
Right.
So they think now possibly, you know, that there mightn't have been, like, you wouldn't get a whiff of the hawthorn now and go, japers, it's just like my old auntie's funeral. You know, you wouldn't get that, of course. But long ago, with the Irish wake traditions, people knew the sights, sounds and smells of death. You know, they were much more comfortable and had much more experience with them. So it's not that they would have got a sniff and then, as I say, went straight back to the funeral, but it might have sent off a little signal, you know, subconsciously in the back of their mind on a primal level, understood that there was something connected with death, with the smell of this flower.
Aideen Tiernig from Bláthanna Fiona on Today with Colm Ó Mungáin. A new art installation was launched today in Dublin. The Portal joins Dublin's North Earl Street with Fifth Avenue in New York by means of a visual bridge. Nollag Fahy from Dublin City Council Culture Company told Carol Coleman Moore on Morning Ireland.
Yes, Carol, this is where technology, engineering, art and culture come to one place. And we're absolutely delighted that New York approached Dublin to see if we would partner with them on this particular project. It's very, very unique. It'll be the third and fourth portal in the world only. So they exist in two other countries at the moment, Lithuania and Poland.
And how does it work?
So there's a live feed. It doesn't record. So it's a live video. And it's between, so what New York sees is they see the GPO, which is an iconic building for the country, and they'll see the spire. And then in Dublin, we will see the Flatiron area and plaza in Broadway. So it's a live feed. It runs 24 hours a day. And so, you know, people can come along and they can wave. Now, there's no sound. So you can't actually speak to people, but you can see your relations. A lot of people are queuing up apparently in New York already to say, you know, we can't wait for to see our relations in Dublin.
And with all the video connectivity we have between us now, literally 24/7, like, why was this thought a good idea for a public art installation?
Well, you would think that, wouldn't you? But actually, when you stand in front of this for the first time, there's something. You know when you're on a train and you see, you know, kids waving at a train and you're waving back, right? There's something about that connectivity that you can't get from a phone. And certainly I felt something, you know, something emotional when I saw somebody in a different city yesterday while we were testing this. Somebody was just passing by and they stopped and they waved. And like, to me, art, you know, should snap you into a moment where you go, oh my God, what's this? And I know you can pick up your phone and make a call and you can see people, but it just isn't the same thing.
Okay, so people are going to be looking for this thing. Where exactly is it located?
Yeah, so, excuse me, at the junction of O'Connell Street and North Earl Street is where the Dublin Portal is located. And then in the Flatiron Plaza in New York, it'll be facing the Flatiron building. So that they're the two locations. We have a very good programme in place to activate the launch today at 4:15 in North Earl Street. Our Lord Mayor, Dáithí Do Rishte, he'll be unveiling it, and we'll have a dance troupe, a hip-hop dance troupe from Dublin City Centre. They'll be, well, it won't be a dance-off, but at the same time in New York, there will be another dance troupe from Broadway doing their thing in front of the portal. So that'll be the official launch. And then we want, basically this has been a project up for 7.5 months to get it to this point. And we want this to be Dublin's portal. Like, we want the people of Dublin to actually embrace this. We also want them to mind it, by the way. So, you know, when it's launched, you know, people can go and activate this themselves. So they don't have to come to us, the culture company, to, you know, plan something. They can contact somebody in New York, an organization, and plan something themselves. For example, we have
lots of connections there. Can I just ask you,
sure,
obviously it's a piece of art out, yeah, in the street. How do you, first of all, will it be working all the time, and how do you protect it from, say, vandalism?
Yeah, well, so it's made of very robust concrete. There's also a very substantial piece of glass in front of the screen. The screen technology itself is, you know, very high end. It's 5G at this point. It's a very clear, like, it's really incredible when you see it. And then, you know, we have a couple of protocols in place around security, around cleaning and etc. If there are issues, but as I said, we really do hope that people will kind of mind this themselves. You know?
Okay, so I can go down and tell my cousin to meet me at the portal at 5 o'clock Irish time, and I suppose you could just turn up and just be conversing with a stranger or watch you waving to a stranger.
Yes, and I mean, when you see this live for the first time, it really is it's striking. You know, like you'll be staring at it, looking at people, and thinking, wow, this is a live stream into another city, like, you know. And it's great that New York approached us, you know, of all the cities they could approach.
Nollaig Fahy from Dublin City Council Culture Company chatting to Carol Coleman on Morning Ireland. Pop culture and entertainment expert Deirdre Malumbi was on today with Colm an Mungo to talk about the best on-screen villains.
It's impossible to start this conversation without focusing on our own Andrew Scott's performance. He's been doing very well in award nominations, but his performance as Tom Ripley in the Netflix series. His performance perfectly catches what we're about to talk about today. It described as spellbinding by one Guardian reviewer. Let's have a little listen to them in that role before we chat.
And how do you propose I get rid of him, Marge? Throw him off the terrace? Push him in front of a bus? Drown him?
I should do it.
Just tell him to leave, Dickie.
He can barely swim, you know. He told me. He's terrified of water.
Andrew Scott there. Deirdre, even he loves Ripley.
It's a very sinister show. And I mean, I think that a lot of credit is due to kind of the show as a whole, as well as Andrew Scott's lead performance as Ripley himself. Because I mean, it's really interesting because all of Ripley is set within Italy. And that's a country I think we've seen brought to the screen, whether it's the small screen or the big screen, so many times before. But the fact that it's set in black and white and the cinematography and production design just makes Italy look kind of disorientating or uncomfortable or something. I remember feeling on edge from start to finish. Whereas most shows that I see set in Italy kind of make me feel very relaxed and like, God, I need to book a trip to Italy sometime soon. But Italy, I mean, Ripley is absolutely an excellent show. I think that what Andrew Scott does with this character is that he really captures kind of the pathetic nature of Ripley, but also kind of his clumsiness. And I think that that's part of the charm to the character. And I think Andrew Scott does just have this kind of natural charisma that he kind of oozes onto the screen. But I mean, his character also does these very, very evil things. He does murder people. And it's interesting seeing the blood against the like black and white cinematography. It has like quite a dramatic impact. And they really do drag out those scenes where he murders people. So it's kind of questionable. Is he a villain? Is he an anti-hero? He just seems to be quite evil at times.
Right. So we sympathize with his vulnerability. We kind of nearly see a context for his actions. There's a bit of sort of bit of sympathy, bit of psychoanalysis going on with the viewer looking at the villain. Is that the way it works?
I think so too. And I think as well, Ripley continues this trend that we've seen in a lot of recent media. Like when I look at movies like The Menu or Triangle of Sadness, which has just been added to Netflix, or shows like The White Lotus or Succession, there's been this kind of trend lately where it's very kind of anti the top 1% of people. And we really like to see the downfall of the uber rich. So I think that Ripley kind of captures that kind of ennui that we're seeing at the moment. And he reminds us of something like kind of a Gatsby figure, you know, who kind of makes his own way, or even like Robin Hood, except that instead of, you know, stealing from the rich and giving to the poor, he's stealing from the rich and giving to himself. So there is something kind of admirable in the qualities that he has. And it makes for a really interesting kind of relationship between character and audience.
And what are the tricks that get people on side with anti-heroes or the likes of Ripley?
I think that it's really key to have exquisite casting. You really have to cast the right people in the role. And I think that actors have kind of often like made their career, say if there are unknowns and they get cast as a really great villain. Or there are a number of, you know, examples of actors, take Anthony Starr as Homelander in The Boys, who've kind of managed to rejuvenate their career by playing these great villains. So I think you really need to have great casting, but you also need to have like great writing. You need a script that's going to kind of challenge the viewer, that's going to make the villain quite likable in spite of the fact that they do these morally questionable and sometimes just pure evil things. And I think that villainous characters, they're always more interesting to see on the screen than the hero. They just have a lot more complexity. Oftentimes you see that they come from, you know, difficult circumstances. Maybe they lost a loved one and they turn to villainy in their grief, or they come from impoverished circumstances, which kind of makes you feel empathetic for them. They also often rebel and break the rules, and I think that there's something quite enjoyable about watching that. And they kind of remind us of our flaws and of our humanity. You know, there is a saying that goes, every villain is the hero of their own story, and that's oftentimes the case.
Right. Well, I suppose if you want to get to know their flaws, it's handy to be able to sit in on their psychotherapy sessions, which, you know, was the case with Tony Soprano, who I think everybody loved despite themselves. We're going to listen to a clip here where Tony is eating with his son Anthony Jr. and his daughter Meadow and her boyfriend Finn in a restaurant.
So Finn, you got any plans for the summer? Going back to Mission Viejo to surf or whatever?
Actually, I'm hoping to stay here in the city.
How's summer school going?
It sucks. I did summer school once. You can still have fun.
Casa Carmela is looking at maximum security summer.
Excuse me a minute.
you cut your mother a break, huh? For the record, she's the one holding this family together in this current situation and all. Read the check, please.
The young man took care of it.
You paid the check?
I figured since you're always so, you know, generous, I should reciprocate.
You're lucky you don't get your head handed to you.
Dad.
Let's get something straight. You eat, I pay.
Mr. Soprano.
No, when you have your own family, you pay. Go.
Just take the money.
Who'd have thought buying your father-in-law lunch could, or potential father-in-law could be so menacing? Look, with Tony Soprano, it's not a spoiler. I think at this stage, people know Tony Soprano is a mafia boss. He's a violent cheat, a ruthless adversary. Why did people love him so much?
I think that James Gandolfini casting is absolute key here. I don't think anybody else could have played that role and brought the kind of charisma and sense of fun that he brings to it. But yeah, he's a very complicated character. You know, he's funny and yet he's conniving. He's short-tempered, but we also see in a number of cases when he's very affectionate and caring, oftentimes with his, you know, two children. He's not a very good husband. He has numerous affairs throughout the Sopranos series. So your heart really goes out to Carmela. But there are a number of reasons why you really do end up on Tony's side. I think part of, you know, the reason is we learn through flashbacks kind of what kind of upbringing he had. His mother is quite joyless and narcissistic, and we see her as a bitter old woman throughout the show. His father was a ruthless criminal, and while he's trying to kind of pull away from that fatherly influence, he also can't help but be impacted by it. I think that the fact that he goes to therapy in every episode of the series really is quite fascinating as well, because I suppose it means that we kind of see him as a figure who is trying to kind of criticize himself, who's trying to analyze what he does and feel some kind of remorse or guilt or attachment to all of that. And he really is trying to better himself. You know, that's what we associate therapy with. It's trying to kind of understand why you do the things that you do and perhaps make better decisions. But at the same time, you know, throughout the series, he does some awful things. We remember the fates of his unfortunate nephew, Christopher, or cousin Tony B. I have to say, for my money, when in the second last series, what he did to Adriana,
The show is very old by now.
If you haven't seen it.
Okay, well, there's probably a whole new generation.
Well, if you haven't seen The Sopranos by now, you're missing out. That was pop culture and entertainment expert Deirdre Malumbi on Today with Colm O'Mungon. And that's all we have time for on this edition of Playback Daily. Remember, you can listen to all the shows in full on the RTE Radio app. So from me, Louise Herity, thanks for listening and take care.